Well, do you ever wish you'd get rid of that double chin? Well, I know I do. Here is Robin S. from Lubbock, Texas. I put that jawline cream on my neck like 2 or 3 days ago. That is the best my neck has looked in over 20 years. That's what she says. That is with Genucel's natural, active, and pure antioxidant base with no parabens, no chemical scents, and no pharmaceutical agents, and no pharmaceutical preservatives. It's the clean luxury your skin deserves every day. Check it out. Order right now. And the Genucel jawline treatment is yours, absolutely free, just for ordering the classic Genucel plant stem cell therapy for bags and puffiness under your eyes. Text the word DREW1 to the number 77453 or go to Genucel.com. Again, that's G-E-N-U-C-E-L, Genucel.com. Works for men and women, and for results in 12 hours or less, the Genucel Immediate Effects is also included free. Order now and get 3-day shipping free. Text DREW1 to 77453. Again, that is Drew, number one, DREW1 to 77453, or just go to Genucel.com. That's G-E-N-U-C-E-L, Genucel.com. And welcome to the Dr. Drew Podcast, everybody. We appreciate it. Please do click through and give some support to the people that allow me to do this podcast. So there's wind in the sail of the Corolla pirate ship. Again, we are trying to be very careful with the people that support it. And we've got some really interesting, good products that are behind us these days. So click through, support the people that support us, and head over to drdrew.com to check out all the other things we have there. We have a lot of things you can click through on there, too, as well. It is my privilege to welcome my dear friend Roger Wolfson today. Wolfson, as I choke on your voice, Roger, on your name. Roger, you can follow him at rogerwolfson.com or Twitter, Roger underscore Wolfson, W-O-L-F-S-O-N. And give me your writing pedigree, your television writing.
Well, the first episode of television I wrote starred Viola Davis. It was a TV show called Century City. And then I went from there to Law & Order SVU and then to Saving Grace and The Closer and Fairly Legal. And one of my episodes on The Closer got Kira Sedgwick nominated for an Emmy.
West Wing, did you write for them too?
I wrote a spec West Wing, which is what got me repped in town. But I never actually did a produced episode of West Wing. Although I will tell you that one of the highlights of my career was Aaron Sorkin interviewed me to be his number two on the Newsroom.
Wow.
And it was just fantastic. And the interview went really well, but I got beat out by – what's it? The guy, Lieberstein, Paul Lieberstein, who played Toby on The Office.
Oh.
And he was hired to be the number two instead of me, and it was kind of not a fair competition because The Office was Aaron Sorkin's favorite TV show.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Toby was the social worker. Right?
Yeah.
HR.
HR, right.
HR. Yeah. He was also – I think he was show running that show too, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, he was show running in the sense of as much – well, yeah. He was show running The Office, yes.
Is that one of your big shows too?
I like The Office a lot, but I was much more interested in the Sorkin aspect of this. I am an admitted Sorkin apologist. There's nothing he's done that I don't like.
Oh, yeah.
Me as well. And if it wasn't for Sorkin, I wouldn't have a career.
Why is that?
Well, because – so, you know, my story was I was working in the U.S. Senate.
Okay. So, Roger – let me just give you a little more of your pedigree. Sure. Roger's got a law degree from the University of Pennsylvania and then an M.A. in writing from Hopkins. Well, how did you go from – did the M.A. come after this Senate stint?
It went during the Senate.
Then – okay.
Yeah, so I got my master's while I was working in the Senate.
Okay. You're in the Senate. You're a lawyer. You're – what would you call that? A staffer?
I was a legislative counsel or my last title was chief education counsel to the Senate Labor Committee.
Okay.
I was working for Ted Kennedy and Paul Wellstone, Joe Lieberman, John Kerry and stuff like that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And that must have been fascinating.
It was amazing, and especially if you're like a young liberal, which I was at the time. I'm still a liberal, but I was younger, and it was the biggest honor I think of my life was to work for Paul Wellstone and Ted Kennedy simultaneously at the Labor Committee. And then Wellstone was killed in a plane crash.
Right.
And he was killed along with his wife and his daughter and 3 members of his staff, one of whom I had helped recruit to come work for him. I don't want to pretend that it was a plane that I could have been on, but because it's not like I had a ticket to or anything. But all the members of his staff really felt like we could have been there with
sure.
him. So my reaction was I sold all my possessions. I sold my condominium in Washington, D.C., which still hurts now because
that would have been good.
Gone up by 10. Oh. And I bought a sailboat. I started sailing around the world. And it was a 42-foot catamaran. And I ended up landing in Los Angeles in March of 2003. wrote this West Wing episode that got me offers of representation from every agency in town, and then I became a TV writer.
But did you have your MA at that point?
Yeah, I had finished my master. The day that I actually got the master's was also the day I got rep by CAA.
Why did you get the master's of writing? What made you do that?
I knew I wanted to do something more creative. As much as I loved politics, and I still do, it wasn't fulfilling something deep inside me. I mean, and you also know because you're a creator as well.
Yeah.
You're a very creative person.
We're going to talk about that eventually.
Yeah. You can't die with this song still in you. You know?
So Roger and I have been writing for like a year and a half, like writing. And really? Roger taught me how to do that. And we met at Lisa Bloom's birthday party like 3 years ago. And he goes, we should talk about it. You have some idea. We should talk about it. And he has this room in his house in sort of Silver Lake, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Silver Lake.
And it's this giant glass window. And he just starts writing on it. And these stories emerge. And the two of us just started collaborating on stuff. It was one of the most fun creative experiences I've ever had.
Well, I would be fascinated to see what you guys come up with.
Oh, we've had three really good shows that we pitched around. Believe it or not, Kaylin.
Well,
what?
Eventually they're going to hit. One's going to hit because the two of you are obviously very talented. No, when Kaylin handed me the bio for this gentleman, you know, I did a little bit of cursory research as I was emailing with him. You know, you sort of sent me an email chain between the two of you and said, book this guy. So when that happens, I just book a guy and then I'll do some cursory research myself, but maybe not do the full deep dive until the day of, you know, when we're getting ready to do the show. And I got to the end of the bio in the middle of our A&D block, and I was like, what the fuck is it? What does this guy not do? Jesus Christ. And he's coming in, and I was like, you don't even have anything on here about the psychedelics, which was what
the
email
was about.
Well,
that's what we want to talk about. We want to talk about psychedelics. Yeah. But we're going to get there. We're going to get to all that. But we did a show. We created a show about a doctor who is he was a psychologist.
Yep.
And he had a talk show, but he had bipolar disorder, and he kind of sucked. But when he became manic, he was magic. So all the producers kept trying to push
him
into manias.
Oh, wow.
By spiking him with meth and things like that. And it was a great show. I loved that show. This is Roger's name, Doctored or Dr. Ed.
Ooh,
so the guy's
I
name
like
was
that.
Ed. It was really fun. And then
I got to tell everybody at home, though, seriously, that those of you who suspect that Drew is one of the most amazing people to hang out with and get to know,
stop.
You're absolutely right.
I got a co-sign. Yeah,
this man behind the scenes is the same as he is on camera.
Well,
he's just
Roger brought out the best to me. We really it was just creative, and then he brings in other writers to workshop stuff. Which how does that happen? How did you learn how to do that?
Well, one of the things I also do is because of the master's, I teach writing.
Yeah.
And I've really learned I enjoy doing it.
Yes.
So I bring writers who want to be mentored into my office and they shadow me for a few hours a day.
Is that what the groups are that would come through there?
I call them my brain trust and they're shadowing me.
Because some of them were extremely talented.
Yeah.
And I felt like they were getting something similar out of the whole experience that I was getting, like just creatively growing from it.
And several of the writers who I've mentored have ended up repped in their own right. Some of them are staffed now.
Wow.
So it's really
nice.
You know, my goal has always been to sort of build a whole a network of people who I've helped in this town. And I think that I think you can relate to this too. Hollywood isn't necessarily a town where people help people.
Mm-hmm.
I got some like Deborah Kahn, who was a writer for The West Wing, and Mark Goffman, who was a writer for The West Wing. These people really helped me out.
Yeah.
And more than any of them even was Lawrence O'Donnell. Lawrence O'Donnell and I had worked on the same floor in the Senate Russell Building when he was working for Moynihan and I was working for John Kerry. And when he ended up on the West Wing, he got offers to do his own shows, and he did a TV show called Mr. Sterling, which starred Josh Brolin, which is about a California senator. And he flew me out to Washington, D.C. To Los Angeles to talk about the show because he thought I might be able to be helpful. And then I just assumed, well, you're going to hire me to write on the show, right? And he's like, no, you got to write a script. And I left his office with 50 episodes of The West Wing. He just handed me all the scripts.
Oh, my gosh.
That's how I learned to write.
I learned to write by
reading Sorkin. And I diagrammed it like a legal case. That's what I did. I mean, I went through how many scenes are in it, how many characters, you know, what are the plot devices that he used. I mean, really applied my legal skills to it.
So I want to drill in that a little bit because I didn't realize – the way you get through law school is with these outlines.
Yes.
Right? And because my son's in it now. And that's – you made an outline out of the script.
Wait, he's going to law school now?
Yeah, yeah. One of my sons.
Well, mazel tov.
Yeah, he loves it.
Yeah.
He loves it. He was a composer and then he – but he was like
– And a mathematician.
No, that's the other one.
Oh, I'm sorry. I get him confused. Yeah,
that's the one you met.
There's three of them.
There's three.
One of them's a girl.
Yes. She just finished an MFA in writing.
You're kidding.
From Columbia, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. She wants to – she's an artiste, wants to write novels and things or nonfiction, creative, whatever. That's sort of the new thing now, right? Essays and stuff like that. That's her thing. She's very good. She's very, very good at writing dialogue. And so I was like, hey, please come talk to Uncle Roger.
Well, I'd love to help her out.
Thank you.
It's something I enjoy doing.
Thank you. So anyway, so these groups come in. They had some really bright, lovely kids that were inspiring. We're in your room there while we scratched up. The next Gary, the next show, was Apple the next one? Did we have something in between?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the next thing is what we kind of wanted to talk about today was people liked our idea but passed on the talk show as a written thing for some reason, didn't really resonate.
It was John Rico and Glenn Ficarra, who were producers of This Is Us, who we pitched, who fell in love with Drew, of course, and also loved our idea. But they were just really straight. These are old friends of mine, and they were really straight with us that it just didn't have enough originality because
the topic. And by the way, sitting with those guys, I felt like I was sitting with the writers of the National Lampoon or SNL in the early 70s.
Yeah.
They're that kind of like, oh my God, these guys have so much to offer.
Isn't it amazing how politically knowledgeable they are and how artistically knowledgeable and also truly good people? And you don't really think that. Like, this wasn't my expectation. It probably wasn't yours when you encountered Hollywood.
Yeah.
You weren't necessarily expecting that people would be of depth and character. And kindness.
Kindness was the word that was the big surprise for me.
But they're there. They're there.
Oh, yeah. And so we were sitting chatting like, what can we do? And I said something about psychedelics. What did I say that?
Well, what it was is I was asking you. I was like really trying to force this out of you. I was like, give me just arenas within the field of psychology.
Yeah, what's going on that's different and new or something, right? Or what's dramatic?
And the second you said the word psychedelic, I was like, that's our show.
Well, he goes, I'd watch a show about psychedelics.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, that's a new area, which is using psychedelics therapeutically. And it's very controversial. And there's lots of stuff around that. And so that's where we went and came up with our new show.
Seems like there's a lot of maybe just cursory. Obviously, they have to go further into the studies, but it seems like a lot of people are talking about how it helped them.
Massively.
A lot more people
is a benefit.
A lot more people talking about their own personal experiences positively, and the other side seems to be people who haven't had experiences with this talking about potential risks of
– Well, you're already into the controversy right there, which is there's therapeutic uses.
Sure.
That are really looking good. PTSD, end of life, interactable, God knows what, panic or things like that. Sort of non-treatable conditions that give people great distress. These look very promising. Yeah. And the risks certainly outweigh the benefits, it appears.
For most people, yeah.
When it comes to sort of what you're talking about, which is just enhancing life.
No, that wasn't what I was saying. What I was saying is it seems to me that you hear from people like Neil Brennan who has used, I think, if I'm misquoting, forgive me, but like ketamine treatments has severely helped his depression.
Yes.
So you hear a lot of testimonials of people talking about how this has been helpful in their experience to them. What you don't see a lot of, at least in the media I'm consuming, is people talking about how they attempted to do this and had a negative outcome. You more see people generally talking about the dangers and the risk, and they maybe don't have experiences with the substances or the treatments.
And it's all mishigas. The research isn't there to be able to tell everybody what dosing, how often, what are the risks really, and what are the potential benefits. And so Roger took it upon himself to figure it out.
And then I think that was also part of what really inspired me about what you brought to it was you were just like, look, as a doctor, as a scientist – why is it that
that could be beneficial?
Right, but this molecule equals bad. Oh, that molecule equals good.
You've heard me say that a million times.
Yeah.
Million.
And so what we did was we actually, interestingly enough, Drew and I wrote an entire episode of this. And we got Dave Navarro involved and
yeah.
a lot
yeah,
of
Navarro was involved with that.
Wow. A lot of interest in it. But we wrote it about 2.5 years ago was when we got – or maybe 2 years ago we got the first version of it really done.
Jesus Christ, was it that
I'm sorry. That's when we started it.
Yes, we started 2 years ago.
And then when we started it, the antagonistic forces in the script were the illegality and the impropriety of researching psychedelics in an academic context.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what happened is over the – just over the course of us writing it, which took about 9 months or so – it just shifted. It became much cooler, much more acceptable, which is what we predicted would happen. It just happened faster than we thought it would.
Yeah, I thought it would take 5 or 10 years. And it's just all of a sudden it's like not that big a deal because it was so much benefit being seen.
Which is great
from a – Joe Rogan to shut up.
Which is great from a public policy standpoint, but from a writerly standpoint, it screwed us.
Yeah.
Because then we had to come up with a different antagonist, which meant basically a page one rewrite, which we're right now in the process of. And in fact, I've got an outline for you that should be ready by this weekend.
Do you want to tell them what the new sort of tweak is?
Well, the new tweak is that we've got a – well, we don't want to give away too much.
Okay,
here,
okay.
But
okay.
we have a main character who is based on somebody that you introduced me to.
Yeah.
Who's a professor at UC Irvine.
Yeah. And let's just say that our character has some of the liabilities that Mr. Carolla has.
Ah. Some, okay.
But in writ larger and – and this – I want to – this woman, I had you review the script.
Right, right.
I'm going to interview her. I'm going to give you her contact information for this podcast.
Great.
So we can flush out the topic.
Well, I'd love to come back and even sitting next to Gary during that one.
Absolutely.
Want, really
more
like
than
to
welcome.
Meet her.
I'm going to be talking to you about Sorkin while you try to listen. But.
Thanks, Gary.
I got it right now. Give her him her contact or I'm going to forget it. But yeah, so now we have lots of different ups and downs and things and it's such a rich story.
I bet. It just seems like there is a ton to explore there, and it seems like the world is sort of going to be exploring it, whether you're doing it in entertainment or not. So why not?
And I'll also confess to this, which is that one of the things that the new version has that the other one didn't is based on a lot of the work that I've been doing with politicians over the last couple of years.
Which I want to get into in a minute.
And I think that maybe in some ways we were helped by the fact that we lost our premier antagonist. Because what we realize is because with the sands shifting underneath the world of psychedelics so swiftly, we needed to make this even more of a character drama. Mm. So we really had to pump out the emotion more. And since both Drew and I have highly developed left brains, sometimes the part that we need to focus on more is the emotional part, the right brain part. And this has forced us to do more of that. And right now, one of the things I'm really looking for when you see the outline is I think that we've really, it's hitting every single.
Well, I would also argue that we're pretty good on emotional subtleties, but this is heating it up.
Yeah, yeah.
This is heating all of that up and making the stakes kind of woof. So let's talk about the politicians.
Sure.
You were out there coaching progressives.
Yes.
On how to present their policy positions, essentially.
Yeah, and it's not just progressives is where I come from, but it's also Democrats in general. So I started up this organization called the Writers Action Group, which is made up of multiple members of the Writers Guild of America, all of whom are particularly interested in – well, not all the ones who I'm working with are particularly interested in helping Democrats. So we've been to Washington now 6 times in the last 2 years giving lectures to the entire Democratic caucus in the Senate, to the entire Democratic caucus in the House, to all press secretaries and communications directors. We're on our way back in the next couple of months in order to give lectures to the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
So let me ask something. Is that typical that a party or a policy position – I don't know how to characterize it – would be hungry for writing input? Or is that a sign of the times that they're looking for a message? They're kind of searching for something.
I think that they're more interested now than ever before because I think the Democrats are realizing that they got their heads handed to them in 2016 and they haven't really been good at telling their own story. Now, the thing is that writers come through Washington, D.C. on a regular basis. Mm. In fact, we met with Al Franken about a year and a half ago, who is a writer himself, and an excellent one. And he said to us, you're just the latest group that's come back over many, many years. The only real difference between you and the other groups is you've got me, Roger. You've got somebody who at least has some political experience. Mm. So the real test of whether you're going to be here for the long haul is if you're here in a year from now. Now, the irony is we're here – we're still there.
He's not.
He's not.
Oof.
But I say that with a real measure of sorrow, in part because I like him, but also because he took Paul Wellstone's seat, who was my boss.
Wow.
And really, I think he ran for office in part because he was so upset that Paul died.
Mm.
And you know, for me, I still feel – I miss Paul Wellstone every day. I miss Al Franken as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he really had a lot to offer.
But that loss clearly had a massive impact on you, the fact that you left D.C. and just got out of Dodge. Was there something specific about that that was –
I think it really was, Drew, when you find somebody in any field who is genuine and principled and decent, it's hard to lose them.
Mm.
But with Paul Wellstone, there were times I was sitting behind him on the Senate floor, and very often, you know, even if it was a speech that I wrote, he would depart from the speech and he would make it so much better. He would elevate the material. And I would sit there behind him and I would be thinking, thank God somebody is saying these things. And there was nowhere in the world I would rather be than standing behind this guy.
Mm.
And the fact that he died also was so tragic. It was 11 days before he was slated to win re-election to a third term. He died under suspicious circumstances. The plane that he went down on really doesn't go down. And he died with his wife and his daughter.
Mm.
And he had a beautiful, beautiful marriage. You know, I still remember. So I was the speechwriter not only for him but also for his wife, Sheila, and their daughter who died with them. Marcia, she once said to me, you know, I wasn't even prepared to get married myself, she said, because I'd never seen my parents argue.
She was afraid that wouldn't be as good.
Yeah. She had unrealistic expectations because their parents' marriage was so respectful and so highly evolved.
Mm.
But, you know, this is something that I think you can relate to. Really self-actualized people are rare. And stick them in an environment where it makes a difference. Like for a good cop, like a really great cop. Or a great politician, or somebody like John Enriqua and Glenn Ficarra, who are producing This Is Us, who now have such a massive success and such a ability to say things. When decent people end up in those positions, it's just really tragic if we lose them.
I get it.
Because they can do good.
Yeah. Let's go back now. What you're teaching the Democrats?
We're trying to teach people to speak from the heart,
and.
You know, the Writers Action Group is great and it's wonderful members, but a lot of it's me.
So explain to me, speak from the heart. What do you mean by that? Because there's a lot of rhetoric these days about feelings, feelings, feelings.
Yeah.
And people are getting a little bit of a pushback on that.
Well, my argument
the heart is
this.
Not necessarily feelings. It can be more from – there's a little wider landscape when you say from the heart.
Well, as you probably know better than most, the decision-making engine for the human being is not centered in the left brain as much as we think. It's really centered in the right.
I agree with you, and I believe that the right brain is processing information out of the body.
Right.
The body is just pulling stuff out, and your body is some kind of antenna to other people too.
Exactly.
But that's what's coming out of there, yes.
Right. So I think that what happened was about 30 or 40 years ago, whenever during the Reagan era, for me at least, the Republicans sometimes stopped really – doing things that made complete sense. Like, and I'm talking about trickle-down economics as an example. I don't really think that works. And a lot of the economics behind it don't add up. But so I think because they didn't necessarily have the facts on their side, and again, this is my point of view, and I'm a liberal, they learned how to argue emotions. Reagan was very good at that. He was very good at connecting to emotions. That made Democrats very frustrated and very shrill. Because they're like, well, no, you're wrong. You're wrong.
You're wrong on the facts.
And so Democrats got stuck arguing the facts.
Yeah.
And if you're arguing the facts, you're in a weak position.
God, in a weird way, Trump is like the next order version of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much.
Yeah.
So, and then that just makes us even more shrill because we're like, no, look at all the things he does wrong. Look at all the mistakes he's making.
Look at
all this.
Yeah.
And then we forget that people don't like the school marm. People don't like the
especially these days. They don't.
Yeah.
They don't know what to do with information.
Right. So
and they don't know the difference between information and the sort of processed information, wisdom.
Exactly. And so, to me, what we've been teaching is, or I've been teaching, are the skills and the tricks of the trade from the writing industry. How is it that we connect to large and diverse audiences in red and blue states? How do we develop long-term emotional relationships with people? And it's always through – and you'll probably appreciate this too. It's through a dopamine cortisol drip, you know, where an effectively told story makes – stresses you out on some level. It releases a little bit of cortisol. And then when there's an effective and complete resolution to it, then there's the dopamine drip.
The reward.
So there, so that creates an addictive storytelling pattern. And it can't work if you're not telling an authentic story. It can't work if you're not telling an emotional story. You have to be able to connect to people where they live and they live in their hearts. So Democrats sort of need to unlearn what they've been doing, which is to argue facts and figures, and relearn how to tell their own personal stories, how to tell their constituent stories, how to create a vision of the future that you can connect to on a deep and powerful personal level.
Is it, am I right that Beto O'Rourke is sort of doing that?
Beto's doing pretty well at that. I would say that Elizabeth Warren does well at that, although she has had, you know, admittedly a couple of missteps. Bernie Sanders is even starting to try it now. But the one who's been doing a really great job of it the last couple of weeks has been Buttigieg, who I also know.
The worst part about him as a candidate is his name.
Yeah, Buttigieg.
There, the,
but also this, the, you know, yeah, even if you spell it, if you try and even
forget
play with it. You're tangling with the mess.
Yes. But I did. Funny, I noticed him today. Yeah. I really wasn't really aware of his candidacy until today. I was like, oh, he's got some interesting ideas. That's it caught me.
And, you know, there's a couple of other that are going to be coming out of the gate. So CNN is doing two town halls on Sunday, April 14th. One is going to be Marianne Williamson, who's a friend of mine as well. She's running for president.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I remember when she ran for city council or whatever, Santa Monica.
She ran for Congress.
Oh, is it Congress?
Yeah, as an independent. This time she's running as a Democrat. But this is a very good storyteller.
Oh, she is. Yeah. Yeah.
And then Andrew Yang, who is also – so CNN is having two town halls, one at, I think, 7 o'clock on the 14th and one at 8 o'clock on the 14th. It's going to be Marianne and Andrew Yang. And I think both of them have a chance of really breaking out as well.
What's the name of her book again?
Her latest – well, her biggest book was Return to Love. But her latest book well, then there was The Healing of the Soul of America, which is a political book. And the latest one out, I'm going to have to get to the name. I think it's The Power – it might be The Power of Love, but I'm not sure.
No, we interviewed her here.
Sorry. Tell me the name of the author again.
Marianne Williamson.
We interviewed her on this podcast, and maybe you can find out for me which podcast that was.
But she has a lot to say, and she knows how to connect.
You found it?
Let's see here. It looks like we had her on All About Women back in the day when that was the thing.
Really?
Episode 17, it says.
I remember interviewing her in this studio, though.
We did a few of those here.
Really?
Yeah, you and I were a ragtag bunch back then.
Can we repurpose that as a Dr. Drew podcast?
Probably. I got to find the right hard drive.
Yeah, she's an interesting interview.
I can also get you on here. I'm sure I can
bring her back.
I'm
sure we'll get her back. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that what'll be interesting about those two CNN town halls is that Marianne is going to be speaking to the heart more than
most. She knows how to do that.
And then Andrew Yang,
it looks like your latest book is A Politics of Love.
A Politics of Love. Okay.
She's a very smart woman with a lot of interesting ideas. Yeah.
And then Andrew Yang is going to speak to the more of the left brain because his basic platform is universal basic
healthcare.
Income.
Universal basic income. And that is – well, it's a good idea.
It's a good idea, but it's failed at sort of at these little test sites where they've tried it.
It's possible. I'm not an expert on it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's going to be very interesting because those are two different types of storytelling, two different types of connecting. It's going to be a very interesting evening.
Of course, I've had unique opportunity to help people out physically and mentally. Blue Emo has been a trusted product, American product, for over 15 years that supports healthy muscles and joints. Now they have a coupon code produced specifically for our audience. Go to blue-emu, that is blue-emu.com today. Use the code 3DREW for a $3 off coupon. It's that simple. Go to blue-emu, add the desired products to your cart there at blue-emu.com, and apply the code again. The code is 3DREW. Blue Emu has a large portfolio of products, all American made and highest quality. Their deep penetrating formula of Blue Emu Original is soothing for tired muscles and joints, maximum arthritis for any arthritic pain, and lidocaine as a numbing pain relief. Not only do these formulas work great, there is no chill, no burn, no odor. Use this opportunity to support your muscles and joints. The code is 3DREW at blue-emu.com. Paint Your Life. It is so easy. Just go to paintyourlife.com and you could have an original painting by a world-class artist done by hand just from a photo. It's a photo of your selection. I thought, no, this can't be right, or it's got to be very expensive or very difficult to pull off. No, no. And if you want a truly meaningful gift, you've got to try paintyourlife.com. They walk you through every step. It is as easy as can be. You get to pick exactly the picture you want and exactly how you'd like it done. There's no risk. If you don't love the final painting, your money is refunded. It is great for decor. It's a work of art. It's not just a picture. It makes a truly special gift for someone you love. Yep, that's it. It's, you know what I'm talking about, where you get your photos painted so they look like a hand-painted painting. Fine art, that's what it is. And right now, as a limited-time offer, you get 30% off your painting. I don't know how we do this. 30% off and free shipping. To get this special offer, text the word DREW, D-R-E-W, to the number 484848. Again, that is DREW to 484848. That's how you get it. You get this special 30% discount just by texting my name, DREW, to 484848. Messaging and data rates may apply. It is paintyourlife.com. If you love my show, you're going to love Showmance with Kevin McHale and Jenna Ushkowitz on Podcast One. Join the former Glee stars and best friends as they interview other dynamic duos about the wild ups and downs of balancing relationships on set. Download the new episode of Showmance with Kevin McHale and Jenna Ushkowitz every week on Podcast One. Well, you've heard me talk about Sunday Scaries. Of course, there's lots of information out there about CBDs or cannabidiol. Lots of anecdotal reports that sound good. The clinical science has not yet caught up with this, and you should be doing this with the supervision and sign-off of your physician. Sunday Scaries CBD can be ordered online from our website, sundayscaries.com, shipped directly to your front door. Also, subscription packages for reoccurring monthly orders at a discounted rate. And right now, our listeners can buy Sunday Scaries with a 10% discount and free shipping. Go to sundayscaries.com. Use the promo code DREW, that is sundayscaries.com, using the promo code DREW, D-R-E-W. Sunday Scaries gummies contain zero THC, which means they are not high-inducing and they're not rewarding in the sense that they can cause addiction, so you don't have to worry about those effects. Check out their post on Instagram, where they post relatable and funny memes to encourage customers to not take life too seriously. It is Sunday Scaries gummies. You can get it at sundayscaries.com. The promo code is DREW for that 10% discount. Well, I've been talking about Zoom forever. This is video conferencing at its best. Of course, video conferencing generally has changed the way we do business, but with Zoom, any of us have access to it. Flawless video, pin drop clear audio. Sometimes I just use the audio. Instant sharing of anything on any device, laptop, tablet, mobile. The HD video is striking, and the first time you see 49 participants live on the screen all together, imagine that. Seems impossible. My dad used to freak out with the idea of video conferencing. It's the video phone. It's here. With Zoom, you can share anything with anyone. Zoom is everything you've always wanted in video communication with amazing features you probably haven't even thought of. You can even set up a green screen. You can do all kinds of stuff. So if you're already a Zoom customer, you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, find out. Visit Zoom, Z-O-O-M, zoom.us to set up your free account today. Meet happy with Zoom Video Communications. Again, it is zoom.us. For your free account, if you're doing video conferencing, you are missing out if you're not using Zoom. Simple as that.
I thought we might move towards that. If they could get rid of everything else and just have universal basic income, it's a very appealing model.
Yeah.
But they tested it in Finland, and it sort of failed. Now, it failed in the sense that – depends what your outcome measures are, right? It failed in the sense that they expected people to feel free to go out and find work, because they were free of the burden of a daily income.
Right.
Didn't work.
Well, in the case of – so UBI now has been picked up. Also, Marianne supports it. I think Buttigieg supports it as well, and probably several others do. The reason that it's picking up steam is because of automation. So automation is coming, and this is – I have to give credit to Andrew Yang on this one because he's written a book about it. But automation is coming, and it is very scary. It's a tsunami of joblessness that's headed our way.
Oh, because of the – yeah.
DREW, like, have you heard any extensive interviews with him?
No.
I mentioned him before, but I heard him on Rogan, and Roger's right. It's kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
When you think about how just it's just elementary. Like, these jobs are going away forever.
But the argument, though, the question is, Is it the buggy whip industry that's going to shift into something else, or these jobs are never going to return in any fashion?
Well, let me ask you something. Within 10 years, we're going to have self-driving trucks, certainly. Yeah. I mean, and self-driving cars.
Yep.
What is a truck driver going to do?
What does a buggy whip manufacturer do, or carriage manufacturer?
Well, they can maybe build something. They build something. I mean, what skill does a driver have that's going to be
Uber?
Applicable? Well, but Uber, they're going to have self-driving cars too.
Exclusively. Could be.
Yeah. And then also, what's a store checkout clerk going to do?
Right.
Because that's all gone. I mean, you've got on the Amazon Go already, which is a place where you won't even see a human being in there except another shopper. You go into that store with your app, you pick up what you want, and you leave.
Yep.
There isn't even a checkout process.
I'm going to bet – well, I don't. We don't know.
Yeah.
We have no idea. But I know I need some kind of human contact in places like that. You know what I mean? They're going to still have to staff. It's just going to be far, far less for sure.
Well, and you do. But remember too that I still find myself, even though I like human contact as well, I still find myself when I go to the Whole Foods at the bottom of my hill, they now have a checkout counter where I don't
– Oh, I do that too.
And I find myself in a rush, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, I do that too. The human part, I just need somebody to talk to. I don't necessarily help me. I just need to feel like there's somebody at the store.
And that actually connects to what we're talking about, though, both with what I'm doing politically and what you and I are doing and what writers are doing with literature, which is that people have emotional barriers up now that are getting tighter and tighter and tighter and bigger and thicker. Because of, you've got social media, so you can connect to people privately whenever you want to. You don't actually interact with people personally. And the end result is that we're becoming more and more private and more guarded. Mm-hmm. So that takes us back to the Democrats and the fact that it really is very hard for Democrats to connect to people because these barriers are up between themselves and their own emotions. Mm. One of the things that I very often say to the people I write speeches for is, if you're not having an emotional experience when you're talking, your audience isn't going to either. So what I work on is getting them to connect to their big emotions. And if they can connect to their big emotions, then they can convey them to people.
You know,
people can experience
it. Adam pointed something out to me. He had a friend who was on a dating app, and he said he found this absolute consistent phenomenon, which was people that identified as moderate. They have to answer questions about what your likes are. People identified as moderates would answer what their likes were. I like walking on the beach. I like the. And he said people that identified as liberal, all instead of putting likes in response to the, what do you like, they put in demands. You need to love my dog. You need to not eat meat. You need to. And people don't like that.
Right.
As opposed to the story about why I believe what I believe, which people would relate to. I think sometimes people have gotten intolerant in the name of tolerance. And that's, I think, where people sort of put the barriers up.
And, and I've had to learn this the hard way myself because, I'm a vegan.
Yeah.
So you and I have had conversations about this before. And I've found that I, no matter how self-righteous I get, I still can't persuade people to be vegan, because it doesn't work to be self-righteous and it doesn't work to demand. And in fact, there's a movie coming out right now, which is called Game Changers, which interviews the strongest man in the world, the fastest man in the world, the toughest woman in the world, the best MMA fighter, and LeBron James, and a whole bunch of other the premier athletes in the world, and they're all vegan. That is going to work, if anything is going to work.
Right, persuasive.
Well, because now you're like, oh, wait, hold on a second. So it's health. So it's not just healthier, but I will perform better. And one of the most entertaining sections of it is they take three NBA players. And they test their sexual prowess by strapping up their genitals to see how erect they get over a course of a night's sleep. And
what?
No joke. And then they feed them a meat meal, and then they put them through this test. The next day, they can study how often they got hard and how hard they got and everything. And then the next night they just give them one vegan meal and do the same test, and their arousal increases. And the level – and like that's
so
that's more
that's
effective.
That's persuasive, yeah.
That's more persuasive
yep.
than no, you shouldn't
yes.
do this.
I was talking to a urologist this morning on a radio show, and we were talking about how the most common cause of erectile dysfunction right now in young people is diabetes. And she goes, if they would just tell them that they're going to lose their erection, I said, I do. I discovered that a long time ago. And I always tell these young adolescents that don't follow their blood sugar. It's like, you're going to – this is where it's going to end up. they shape right up. So it's a good motivator. let's switch over to hallucinogens and
yes.
what you're thinking about that. Where is your head at with hallucinogens now? And not only that, maybe we should talk about spirituality generally.
Yeah. Thank you for that, because one of the things too is that, you know, even in our own creative process, it is easy to get caught up in the details ourselves. Mm-hmm. But what led us to it was, first of all, our fear of it. You and I were both afraid of hallucinogens, if I don't mind my speaking on your behalf.
Oh, yeah.
We're scared of them because we appreciate and value our minds and are dependent on them.
And I've seen, you know, I worked in a psychiatric hospital for decades. I saw stuff. I saw stuff, and it affected my thinking.
So we thought, wouldn't it be cool to go into territory that scares us?
Yeah.
The second thing was, we also believe, you and I think, have spiritual leanings, but we're skeptics.
Yeah.
And we want to take a look at that.
And I think we both identify that there's something like a spiritual vacuum in this country right now.
Exactly.
Like we need something.
And I think there's only been a couple of approaches to spirituality publicly. One has been traditional religion.
Religion, yeah.
Which doesn't work for me.
And you came out of a stringent background with that.
I was raised an observant Jew, and then I converted to Islam to marry my ex-wife. And during the time that I really studied Islam, and I really studied Judaism, and I spoke Hebrew, and then picked up a little bit of Arabic when I was married. But I never found God through either of those approaches. And in fact, I was kind of resentful of God. If you read the Old Testament, which is, by the way, involved in both religions, God doesn't come off so good. God comes off like a jerk.
Angry, rapacious.
Exactly.
Punishing.
It's hard to connect to that. And then you've got sort of new age spirituality, which very few people in that field come off as grounded. And a lot of it feels like real wish fulfillment. Like it's really like, wouldn't it be great if
– Right.
But wouldn't it be great if spirituality doesn't always work for me?
Mm.
So we thought, okay, these hallucinogens – have been a part of human development since prehistoric times.
Well, you discovered that it's perhaps a reasonable theory is that the Bhagavad Gita was off a hallucinogenic experience.
Yes, yes. And certainly these shamans, so the first real spiritual speaker for the people were shamans. And that goes back to, again, to prehistory. And most likely they were doing things like shrooms.
Something.
Right.
Something altering.
Right. And that was how they were connecting to the collective unconscious.
Even the possibly the Oracle of Delphi, there was some sort of gas that came up out of the chamber of the Apollo temple, right?
Yes,
one of the theories, and she was having some sort of something experience as a result.
And then you and I are big fans of Jung, and Jung really looked into all this.
Right.
So we're like, okay, let's take our look into it and let's come up with who – and the original vision of our show was from the lead character was going to go from scientist to shaman.
Right.
And we really decided, and we've just taken a bigger leap toward it. And with the latest iteration, we decided to make her somebody who was truly left-brained and really rigorous in her scientific process. So she would be the last person who would start mixing
path.
Her own herbs and wearing flowers around her neck and leading group meditations and the like.
Right.
So, and we really wanted to look at that. And I think that for many, many people since the dawn of humankind, they have found their connection to something bigger with a little help. And that doesn't even mean that they needed it from then on, but it was almost from everything I've studied and from podcasts you sent me, from other people you've interviewed, very often it's by taking these medicines that people first get their glimpse of it and then they know what to aim for. And what's really interesting
– my buddy Duncan Trussell talks about it, taking an elevator up. You look out, you see it, you get what it is, then you go to the elevator back down. Now you got to work your way back through more definitive means.
And you also introduced me to several pioneers in the field, and I've had fascinating conversations with them. And I think that what we really have learned is that there's something there. There really is something there. There is a communication. And we also studied we looked at ecstasy, which is very often called the empathy drug because it breaks down the – and you may remember. I don't remember off the top of my head right now, but it shuts down a certain region of the brain that forms separations.
Right.
And then suddenly you don't feel separated from the people around you. And we also – there was a documentary about the people who first came up with LSD, who first really started mass marketing it.
And the fact that there was a lot of study going on in this country in the 60s. They were really on their way using it as a therapeutic product.
And they believed that if enough people on the planet actually took LSD, that was their belief system, that we would save the planet because people would never be able to come back from that. They would feel connected. They would feel responsible. They would feel connected from nature and the like. So, yeah, this is important stuff.
It's very interesting. And has your ideas about it changed?
I think that I've become more committed to trying myself. So I've tried shrooms. And when you and I met, I had never done anything like it, but I've tried shrooms now twice. And for me personally, and again, I don't want to advocate anything illegal for anybody.
Sure.
For me personally, it was a net positive in every way. There was nothing negative about it. There was no hangover. There was no feeling stupid like I felt when I've tried marijuana. There was no being hungover like when I've tried alcohol. There was just a sense of this beautiful visual experience where I literally sat and looked at the walls of external walls of my house, and it became a movie.
Mm.
It just became this beautiful mosaic of Egyptian mythology and waves and dancing people. It was really remarkable.
Did you feel connected to something different or different about the world?
I felt connected to the people I was with at the time. Mm. The people I was with, I just felt this pure love for them.
And did you have any – did it make you look at the world different? That's what often people will say. It's like it just changed my perspective a little bit. That
I think it just made me realize on a very simple level that everything was okay. That everything was okay. And I felt connected to myself.
It's a pretty powerful feeling.
And you know something, you know, and here's another thing I can say to the benefit, you know, as positive about mushrooms, is that I didn't then go into it the next day, even though I felt something which is rare for me, true calm, true peacefulness, and true connectedness. And I tend to be a very busy person like you, and I tend to have a lot going on in my head in a given time, and I don't always sleep that well. I didn't go out and do it the next day.
The mushrooms.
Yeah, I didn't.
So you had no desire to do it again.
I didn't have a desire. It just there was nothing addictive about it.
Right.
I just knew, okay, that's my little vacation spot, and I know I can go back to it.
Mm.
And so, actually, I planned on doing it this last weekend.
You tried to get me to do it with you.
Yes, I did. And then you weren't available, so I lost interest.
Oh, I'm intrigued by it. I really am.
Yeah.
By the way, I didn't mention that you can. Check out writersaction.com if people want to be a part of the
– Absolutely.
Or what is that if you want to be consulted by you or what is it, writersaction.com?
Well, if you're a writer or if you're somebody within the Writers Guild and you'd like to be involved, I'd love to find room for you. But we are now working with – and so I've been in a different city every single weekend day for this calendar year.
I see you on Facebook or Instagram or something. I think these different groups.
Yeah.
Very different variety of people in there.
It's been
very
remarkable.
Interesting.
And so it's not just political people I've been working with.
Huh.
It's been attorneys. It's been heads of nonprofits.
Seems
it's
like
been
young
doctors.
People really want that.
A lot of young people. I've been working through with an organization called the New Leaders Council.
They want what you got, it seems like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's been really moving. Because there is a – so you know, one of the reasons I've always loved you is that one of the roads not taken for me is psychology.
Mm.
And I think a lot of people feel that way too. I wonder if Gary does too. I mean a lot of us kind of wish that we could be psychologists so we could really just kind of help people on that fundamental level.
Yeah.
What I do with this kind of training is very psychological. Because what I've got to do, let's say it was you. Let's say you decide you wanted to run for office, which, by the way, if I could encourage you to do it, I'd do it in a heartbeat, no matter what party you want to write for, no matter what seat you want to run for. But if you did, I might even have a hard time with you because you do this, I think, pretty easily. But the first thing I would want to do is really get to the heart of why you want to do it. Really the heart of why you want it. Find the fire in your belly. And very often, more often than not, in fact, that fire in your belly comes from some deep, deep pain.
Sure.
You know, you want to make a change because of something some hurt that you felt in the past, some deep, deep hurt. It was very interesting too. So there was one time with Paul Wellstone, and I don't think I've ever told this story publicly. I was in the car with him. I used to drive him a lot. because I just liked spending time with him. And he had just given a speech to a group of college students. It was like something, some kind of fellowship program. And he'd given the speech to them. It was really inspirational and upbeat. But none of them knew what I knew, which is right before he gave that speech, Al D'Amato, who was at the time the chair of the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee, had put out an ad that was the harshest ad about Paul Wellstone ever put out. I mean, it was just mean. His face morphed into the face of a criminal who had just gotten a furlough or something. It was really dark. And Paul, I knew there was a cloud over his head. I knew he was really hurt by it. And then he gave this uplifting speech to these kids. And I asked him, how could you do it? How did you find that in you to be so uplifting and so positive? And he looked at me and he said, what's something I didn't expect to come from him? And he said, fury. I'm so angry at those people. Not the kids, but mm-hmm. I'm so angry at the people who are lying to them and taking things away from them. And then he got emotional. He started talking about his mother. His mother, Paul Wellstone's mother, was the kitchen counter lady at his school. And he got to see, and he was, to start with, he was a small kid who became a wrestler because he was picked on a lot. But he got to hear kids making fun of his mother every single day.
Yes.
You know, no, the kids in school don't like the kitchen counter ladies. Mm. You know, they don't like them. And he got to see that. And so it really became ingrained in him to stand up for the people who are helping you every day who you don't treat well.
Mm.
And it was really beautiful to see. But even with Wellstone, who again was one of the sweetest people, most gentle people, he was a fighter. And the fire in his belly came from people being taken advantage of. So that's what I do. I work with people. I help them figure out why they care about what they're doing, whether it's politics or anything else. And most often, it's some kind of pain, and they have ended up politically involved or became a leader in some right in whatever field they ended up in to exercise those demons. So in some ways, I'm a little bit of I exercise people's demons.
That's deeply psychological.
It is.
Deeply.
And it's satisfying to me because I really – and this is another thing too, which is this is – it's almost like don't try this at home.
Yeah.
And you've seen this too because you've seen me do it. Not this specific thing, but you've seen me do this with story. If you're going to take somebody into that deeply painful place, you got to be able to bring them back.
Sure.
And the way I bring them back is I help them tell that story using and engaging the senses and engaging the emotions and, you know, the sense of taste or smell or touch so that they can relate to it. And I help them pick the story because everyone has multiple origin stories. I help them pick the story that connects to their competence. I help them get back, go to that emotional place and come back almost like I'm forgetting the myth of the man the Greek who went down into Hades.
Hercules.
Yeah, okay. I think there's several different
also,
ones.
Also, I think, yeah.
It was the man with his – he had a wife that he went down to get. He went to
Homer?
Claim it.
Homer? It was
I think it was probably Homer's saying of it.
Yeah, yes.
But
Catabasis?
What'd you say?
Catabasis?
No, it's
Well, I'm sure right now there are many of your listeners who are screaming at their microphone.
So who went to Hades? He went down into the afterlife and messed around with the dead people.
The problem is he brought his wife back, but then he was told not to look at her, and the last second he was afraid she wasn't there and looked, and so it didn't work out for him. But that's what I try in a positive way. I take them down into their little hell, but then I bring them back in a way so that they now have something they can use.
It's funny. I just was thinking about some of this stuff for myself recently. I was doing another podcast with Bob Forrest, the guy who I did Celebrity Rehab with, and he was teasing me for being less serious. Oh, here it is. Here's the Homeric poem. Oh, he's
Hermes.
Yeah, it was Odysseus. Go look at Odysseus. It was Odysseus, and there it is. Yeah. Anyway,
I need a Gary in my life. I need a Gary who's just falling around and just making everything
and putting up on a screen nearby. But he was giving me grief for sort of like becoming less serious and kind of going backwards, like I was getting more immature.
Yeah.
And he said, "What was that? You know, when you were so much more uptight." And I went, "When I was doing medicine full time,
yeah,
I just thought what I was doing was so
important. I don't know how else to describe it than that. I guess it was because it's in my family heritage, and my dad and my uncle, everybody was. But I just thought it was so important, like so important that my own well-being did not even come close to mattering relative to the importance of doing this to help other people. It was weird. I was a weird insight I had.
You know, I think that there's an insight in there for me too, because I'm curious about this, Drew. When you felt – when you had that feeling like what I'm doing is so important, were you less nice of a person, do you think?
Yes.
Yeah.
I do, because I was – because it was – I could be nice, but I would be so overwhelmed all the time and not attending to any of my own needs that I was harried in a hurry, impatient, that kind of thing.
Well, that's and that's almost a confession I want to make if there's friends of mine listening to this, which is that for the first 2 years when I was doing Writer's Action, up until about maybe 6 months ago, I felt like what I was doing was so important that I wasn't pleasant, or I could be unpleasant. In fact, and I lost some friends over it, and it I think part of what
isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And it's not like I had to stop thinking what I was doing is important, but I had to start realizing I wasn't the only person doing important things.
Ooh, nice. You know? I would have said you got to create some balance in your life so you're not so you are filled up a little bit so you can have the energy to be nice to people.
I'm still working on that.
But you're right. It's that you're not the only one doing something important.
Right. Right.
That's really
just because I'm doing
I'm
something
embarrassed
important.
That didn't occur to me.
Just because I'm doing something important shouldn't make me self-important.
Right.
You know, and I think also part of it too was I thought about people like Wellstone. And also I think you had an impact on me as well. I thought about people who are always, at least in my experience, decent to people. And it made me want to be a better man. You know, made me want to be more decent as well.
Isn't it the case that there's sort of no reason not to be? That's what I always thought. It's like
I think you talk yourself into not being. I think you rationalize it. At least I have. I say, okay, well, you know, there isn't a good reason to be a jerk here, but God damn it, this has to be done by this hour, world's going to crash.
But
I
don't know how you avoid that with certain endeavors.
Well, I think part of it, you get kicked in the teeth enough.
Yeah.
You know, because you also know I went through a divorce. So I think
that – do you think that's some of what happened there?
Well, I know that I could be difficult in my marriage. I know that she could be too. I mean, I was married to an Egyptian Muslim. I was an American Jew. We had our work cut out for us.
Oh, by the way.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can create a mismatch.
Yeah. But, you know –
did you do all the Egyptian investigations with her? Was she –
No, I'd already been to Egypt five or six times before I even met her. So I've been studying Egyptian mysticism for many years before I even met her. But I think that was part of the attraction, which is that I was somebody. She wasn't an Egyptian. She wasn't an American Egyptian. She had never lived in the United States until we met.
Oh boy!
And
how'd you guys meet?
We met. You know, it was just one of those amazing things. We just met in my house. So
Wait.
Let me see if I can tell this story.
She'd never been to the United States, but you met in your house?
She'd never lived in the United States. She had visited a few times.
Yeah.
But the short version of that is that, you know, I was writing for this TV show called Fairly Legal. And at the time when I was writing for it, it was about a lawyer who lived on a boat. And I was a lawyer who lived on a boat. And so I was like, you know, first day in the writer's room, I'm like, I have job security. There's no way I can get fired. And then the first thing that the showrunner, his name is Peter Ocko, said was well, got bad news for you. First of all, everyone should disabuse themselves of the notion that this is a law show because this is really about the character. So it's not a law show. And I'm like, okay, well, at least I live on a boat. That's what I'm saying to myself. And then he said, and the network hates the boat. They're going to blow it up in the next episode. So like my whole day just was shot. And then it just got worse because he said, before we blow up the boat, we need to figure out what does it mean. Let's use this as our first exercise as a writer's room. What does it mean? What does it represent? To be, you know, an adult, to be a lawyer who lives on a boat. And I'm getting nervous here.
Oh, what they're going to say.
And the first thing they say is irresponsible. Peter Pan complex.
Immature. Yeah.
Doesn't want to grow up. Island in himself. Antisocial. All this sort of stuff. And then finally I blurt out, all right, I live on a boat. And everyone thought I was being self-effacing. It was a good joke. And they all laughed. But then they realized I was serious and they stopped laughing.
Uh-oh.
I put the boat on the market the next day.
Oh.
Because I was like, you know, maybe if that's maybe that's why I'm still single. If that's the information I'm sending to the universe. So I bought the house in Silver Lake that you've seen, and it took me 9 months to furnish it and, you know, plant the trees around and build the amphitheater. You know, I have an amphitheater and all that sort of stuff. And then the day it's – literally like the day it's done, I come home to my house and I walk in and there's this beautiful Mediterranean woman standing in my living room. And I look at her and I'm like, I'm going to marry her. And she had the same feeling about me, and that was my ex-wife.
What was she doing there?
She was visiting my best friend, who's an ophthalmic surgeon, and she had been a patient of his that he befriended, and he was staying with me in the house.
Crazy,
yeah. So, and it was you know, she'd been in the States several times, but she didn't live there until she moved in with me.
If he has any tips for dry eye, let me know.
Well, you know, I've talked to him about you. I will make that connection.
Thank you.
Because he's right now in Thailand writing a book, but soon as he gets back, yeah.
Crazy,
interesting guy.
Wow.
Yeah,
ophthalmologists are very smart. It's not easy to get those residencies.
Yeah.
Smart dudes. Well, Roger, as always, it is a privilege to spend time with you. I just enjoy it so much. And writersaction.com, people can go and be a part of it. RogerWolfson.com, imagine, as well, right?
Yes.
And Twitter at Roger_Wolfson. Anything you want to say before we wrap it up?
I just really enjoy spending time with you, too. And if it takes being on your show in order to hang out
That's
with
all right.
you,
I know.
I'll be on the show anytime.
Okay, done and done. Gary, anything?
You're welcome anytime, Roger.
Thank you.
And we'll see you all next time.
For calling times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's DRDREW Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or DrDrew.com.